The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
All right,
my name is Matt Carney. Again, I'm one of the co-directors, and this is my other moot court co-director, Sabrina Jawed. We're going to spend a little time talking about moot court. We have a sample oral argument for you, and then tomorrow.
Hi, I'm Elaine Theodosian, president of Mock Trial. I have Will Schiffman here, VP of Communications for Mock Trial, Public Relations, and Antonio Valiente, Executive Vice President for Mock Trial.
All right, so the first thing we're going to do is just talk to you guys about moot court, talk to you guys about the Alvina tournament, give you a brief oral argument demonstration, and then throw it over to Mock Trial, and hopefully get you guys out of here on time with a little more information. So, first and foremost, what is moot court? Moot court is basically appellate argument. Think arguing in front of the Supreme Court. It's, generally speaking, just you and the judge. You'll give an argument based on an appellate record, and the judge will ask you questions about that record, and you tailor your arguments to that. Typically, in most moot court competitions, there's a brief writing component where you have to write the brief, as is in all appellate litigation. For the Alvina tournament, for the first year tournament, we don't make you guys write a brief. It's solely an oral argument tournament. So in that sense, it's different from a lot of moot court tournaments, but that oral argument piece remains intact. And Sabrina will talk to you guys about what Alvina is.
All right. Alvina is a tournament that's exclusively for 1Ls, and it basically takes place over a weekend in January. We have the finals then on the following Friday. There are preliminary rounds on Saturday, quarter and semifinal rounds on Sunday, and then the final round, which is going to be in front of real court judges on the Friday following that Sunday. Alvina basically consists of each of you, if you choose to compete, you will compete in two oral arguments on the same side on Saturday. And if you advance, you'll have one in each round on Sunday and Friday. So Sunday if you advance to the quarter and semis, and Friday if you advance to the finals. You'll get the problem after finals of this semester are over. And so this isn't really going to impact your schoolwork. And, you know, you're welcome to work on the problem to the extent that you want. It doesn't require any outside research. So you're sort of limited to what we give you in the materials. And basically, your job is to come up with an argument and present it, like Matt was saying. And you'll have a better idea of what that looks like when we do our sample moot. So that's what Alvina is.
So now, basically, that's an information. And our pitch basically comes down to this. Why do Alvina? Why take a weekend to come in here and orally argue? And there are a couple very good reasons. First and foremost, I think, this is something you're going to have to do in your legal rhetoric class second semester for grade. Part of legal rhetoric second semester is an oral argument, both at the appellate level and the trial level, and you're graded on it. And I can tell you from experience, and I think anyone who's gone through it can tell you, the first time you stand up for an oral argument, there are jitters, there are shakes, it's a little nerve-wracking. This way you can get all that stuff out of your system when it doesn't really count, when you're not doing it for a grade. So that's huge, I think, and you walk into your oral argument in your legal rhetoric class much better prepared, much more confident, and a little intimidating to your classmates, to be perfectly blunt. Another big reason, if you are interested in coming out for the Moot Court Honor Society, or if you think you might be interested in coming out for it, this is a great opportunity. We allow you guys to participate both in the Moot Court and the Mock Trial 1L competition, so to let you get a flavor of both. Oral argument is probably something you're less familiar with than Mock Trial, so, and certainly Mock Trial is a great 1L competition as well. But this is an opportunity to get you guys familiar with oral argument, which is in the appellate process. Also, it's an opportunity to get you looking at a problem, analyzing it, and coming up with arguments, something that is also big in legal rhetoric in the second semester, because this is when you write your brief. And law school, and if you're interested in litigation, your practice going forward. This is the first opportunity to sort of have that appellate record, black and white, in a piece of paper, look at it, and attack the problem. So in that sense, it's a great opportunity. And this is, we see this for you guys, not, I mean, it's a competition, we keep score, there are people who end up winning, there are people who get trophies. We see this as an educational opportunity for you guys. Our judges aren't out there to cut you down. Our judges aren't out there to make your life hard. Our judges are out there to get you guys an opportunity to answer questions, to make an argument, and then to give you some positive feedback so you can be better as an oral advocate down the line. So I hope that you guys can at least come away with that, that we look at this as an opportunity for you. So before I open it to questions, just a couple quick dates. I know Sabrina touched on most of these. The week before Thanksgiving, the 17th to the 21st, we'll be tabling, along with mock trial, downstairs. So you guys can sign up. It's going to be $15. It's just a nominal fee for us to cover food and trophies and all those assorted costs that come along with this. December 22nd, the first weekday after finals are over, the problem will be released. We'll be emailing it and posting it on our website. So wherever you guys are, wherever your home is, it'll be there for you. January 16th is the last day for anyone to drop from the competition. We emphasize this now just so you guys are aware of it. This is a big logistical project for all of us, so we ask that if you do decide to drop out, which is fine, you do it before January 16th so that we have the opportunity to plan and to make this a great event for everyone. And if you don't, and if you drop out later, unfortunately, and we don't say this to be mean now, which is so that everyone knows, if you drop out after that, you won't be allowed to try out in our spring qualifying tournament. So that's not to kind of drop the hammer on you guys. That's just sort of so that everyone's aware. And then January 24th and 25th is the big show, and Friday the 30th is the final round. If you don't make it, we're going to publicize the heck out of it, and we're going to encourage as many people to come as possible. We're still lining up judges, but they are going to be from the bench and a good panel. So you guys have any, before we get to our model oral argument, do you guys have any questions about moot court and Alvina? Yes?
So everybody wants to do it, can, or like, basically that's my question.
Everyone wants to participate in Alvina?
Yeah, can, is there like a selection process?
No, absolutely. If you want to participate, sign up, and you're in. Absolutely no bar of any kind, so. 1Ls, yeah, you have to be a 1L. No 2Ls, yeah.
What's the deadline for signing up?
It's going to be the November 21st, so in a couple weeks. And you can, again, you can drop out any time before January 16th, so without penalty. Yeah?
Is the rubric for scoring released to the public, or is it just held by you all?
You mean the ballot?
Yeah.
I don't think we've ever released it in the past, per se. But, I mean, we're certainly going to make it clear to you guys what you're going to be judged on. I mean,
like, at the point is that we want to teach you what you're doing right and wrong. So, like, at the end of both rounds that you have, you'll get a lot of feedback from the judges to help you so that if you do then decide to do SQT, that feedback will come in handy. So,
are there, like, preparatory sessions after people have signed up on the 21st? Like, for the people that do sign up, like, is there a prep session saying, you know, this is how long it has to be, it's all those, like, kind of things?
Sure. We're actually going to hand out for you guys in a few minutes a memo with all of that basic information. We're going to have in just a moment a sample oral argument for you guys to watch. We're also podcasting this right now, which is why I'm ridiculously holding this lavalier. And we're going to put up on our website some videos from previous Alvina tournaments, from our First Amendment tournament this year and last year. So we're going to make as many resources available to you guys as we possibly can. All right, well, with no more... Oh, sorry.
What's SQT?
The SQT, real quick, is the Spring Qualifying Tournament. That's the tournament to actually gain membership onto the Moot Court Honor Society. So, all right. So without any further questions, I'm going to turn the mic over to Alex Kwan, our executive team director, and he and our president, Mallory Brown, are along with Kim Trimble, are going to do a sample oral argument for you guys to see. It'll be short. It'll get you guys a flavor of what we're going to do. And then mock trial will come up and talk to you guys as well. Thanks a lot.
Stick around for the mock trial.
trial part.
Yeah.
Yes, please do. Okay, just to give you guys a quick synopsis of what the problem is we're going to be arguing, just so you guys can kind of follow along. Basically, this kid, George Iemma, dyes his hair green. It's long, it's annoying, and he gets expelled from school, essentially. He sues the school, saying that it was a violation of, those are three arguments, First Amendment free speech, due process, and equal protection clause. We're not going to argue the due process argument for time constraints, but basically his argument is that his being expelled from school for having this kind of crazy green hair that was, you know, past his shoulders, he says, I'm Rasta, so it's expression of my speech and whatever, that violated his constitutional rights. School said that they had a legitimate government interest in restricting that speech and thus did not infringe on his constitutional rights. So that's basically the argument that we're going to be doing.
The arguments are 15 minutes. We're just going to do an 8-minute. May it please the court. My name is Kimberly Trimble, counsel for the petitioner, George Iemma. Would the court like me to begin with the statement of facts?
Good thing.
Since this is a review of summary judgment, the court reviews the case de novo. Keeping in mind that summary judgment that was in favor of a party with a burden of persuasion is inappropriate when the evidence is susceptible to different interpretations. In this case, summary judgment was erroneous because George Iemma, First Amendment rights and 14th Amendment equal protection rights were violated. His First Amendment rights to symbolic speech were violated because, as a matter of law, the school bears the burden of proof in showing that the speech materially and substantially interfered with the school's goals, and in this case, the school did not uphold its burden of proof. The equal protection violation was the violation of Iemma's equal protection rights exists because there's elevated scrutiny for sex-based classification. And in this case, the school did not have an exceedingly persuasive justification for this classification.
Counselor, your First Amendment argument, doesn't the Supreme Court's decision last year in Morse v. Frederick give the school considerable discretion on have they even raised the Tinker standard that you mentioned?
The Morse case limited the Tinker standard. However, the Morse case is limited to cases of illegal drug use, promoting illegal drug use. In that case, the student held up a sign that said, bong hits for Jesus. And the concurring opinion, which was necessary for the majority, said that this case was limited to its facts and only pertained to illegal drug use.
What about Morse? You can't really disregard Morse. How is this even speech that's protected?
Speech that's protected would be symbolic speech, which is intended and understood to symbolize message. In this case, Iemma's hair was a symbol of his opposition to the war in Iraq. And his hair could be understood because at least one other student had a hairstyle of this manner. And that Iemma was a member of a group that opposed the war.
I'm going to be honest with you. I'm not terribly convinced that I see a person's green hair and I can understand that that's what that means.
Well, the message...
Counselor, doesn't the test from Spence for symbolic speech ask if the viewer would understand that message to be speech and to communicate a message? So if the viewer did not understand that to be a message, how is that symbolic speech?
I see a guy with green hair. I just figured he likes better green hair. I don't think about the war.
Yes, Your Honor, you're correct that the viewer has to understand this, and as Your Honor points out, you may not understand the message. However, the Spence test also calls for understanding context, and in this context, Iemma had been a member of a political group that opposed the war in Iraq, and Ronkin, the principal, acknowledges that sometimes school gossip informs people's understandings of messages that perhaps care can send. So in this case, it's reasonable for a juror to understand that other students could understand his hair to be a message of his opposition to the war. So in this case, the First Amendment right to symbolic speech obviously exists, and the only real question is whether the school had a substantial justification for restricting this speech. In this case, there's no justification. The only two that are offered is either that there's a discipline problem because of a small disruption in Heiko's class, English class, or a gang justification. I'll start with Heiko's class. In that case, it was a small disruption of two other students playing with his hair. And in the Tinker case itself, which it was a case about wearing black armbands to oppose the war in Vietnam, the dissent points out that there was distractions. in the classroom. But
so what would be substantial disruption to allow a school board, which you've given broad discretion to control speech which disrupts the educating environment within school grounds? What line are you asking us to draw that's sufficient disruption that we can restrict the student's speech?
The sufficient disruption would have to be more than merely one class being disrupted. As the
two.
I would argue that it would have to be more than mere disruption in the class. It could be handled the way that Ms. Heiko handled it. Ms. Heiko asked Ayama to leave the class. He immediately left, and the class could continue. So in that case, that's not a substantial disruption. It took mere minutes to remove Ayama from the classroom and move on with her lesson. And moreover, in the Tinker case, there was indications by the dissent that there was actually more disruption than merely causing a class to have a few minutes. There was hostility outside of the classroom, and the court still didn't find this to be substantial disruption. So without defining exactly what is substantial disruption, this court can at least find that this does not rise to the level.
And what about the possibility of gang affiliation? I mean, isn't that a substantial concern of the school does?
Although gang affiliation is certainly a substantial concern, this is not the true justification for the regulation. The regulation was written in 1968, and as Principal Ronkin recognized, the gang problem has only happened within the last couple of years. So as the court outlined in U.S. v. Virginia when talking about equal protection, a justification will not be accepted if it's merely made up after the justification, after the regulation has been written.
So, Counselor, isn't that about distinctions based on gender? That doesn't inform the First Amendment standard, does it?
Yes, Your Honor. That is talking about the justification for the gender split. And if we could move to that, the regulation itself explicitly writes male students are required to keep their hair trimmed to a reasonable length. On its face, this is a sex-based classification, which is a violation of equal protection unless there's an exceedingly persuasive justification. Now, the two justifications for this violation were also the gangs and the substantial supposed destruction in the classroom. And as I mentioned before, these justifications were made up after the fact.
Well, I'm a little bit concerned because I understand your argument that it may not have been written in any kind of educated legislative history that was their justification at the time. However, if I'm correct, their primary concern is just maintaining an orderly, educated environment. And later on, if gang problems do become a problem, I'm a little bit troubled that you're saying just because they don't explicitly state that in school, then basically we have to wait until a couple kids get shot and then tell this guy to get out of school.
I understand your troubles. However, in this case, Ayama had his first trial for almost a year before this action was taken against him. If the school was truly concerned about his hair being related to gangs, they wouldn't have waited so long to instigate this action. And therefore, a juror...
Does it just reflect that they're trying to give him some leeway, that they're not trying to make a rash decision?
No, actually, in other cases of students whose hair supposedly violated this regulation, the principal asked the student to change their hair before suspending them. And in this case, they suspended Ayama.
Yes, Ayama. He gave notice, and Ayama chose to not wash his hair. Or he didn't give a justification. He had a whole day, and he just said, I felt like it.
As this gets into due process, I'll defer that to my other counsel. However, in this case, notice and hearing requires a chance to defend the position. And in this case, Ayama had no chance to explain what his hairstyle meant before the school suspended him. They suspended him and then listened to his arguments. I see my time is up. May I briefly conclude? In this case, the lower court erroneously granted summary judgment for the school. The grant was erroneous because the school did not provide evidence that Ayama's hairstyle materially and substantially interfered with school obligations of discipline and preventing gang violence. And the school did not prove that there's an exceedingly persuasive justification for the sex-based classification. So in conclusion, this court should reverse summary judgment and allow Ayama to have a trial to prove that his rights have been violated.
Okay, now let's talk about mock trial. And actually, we have one of our competition directors here. Right here.
Hey, y'all. I'm going to literally talk because I got held up coming down here, but I got some time. My name is Mike Drew. Chair. I'm one of the directors of the 1L competition this year. The other director is Scott. He wasn't able to be here today. We already passed around these sheets to you guys, right?
Yep.
We all knew we not got one.
That's going to be special. Okay. The important things that you guys need to know about this are pretty much on this sheet already. Our date for the closing argument competition, it's a two-day event. The preliminary rounds are Saturday, January 31st, and then we have four competitors that will be invited back on Sunday for the semifinal and final rounds. All right, well, I've just been informed that our fee actually had to change. The SBA is forcing us to keep it at the same rate as moot courts. We're trying to keep it as low as we could for you guys, but the SBA has asked us to make it 15. So the fee is actually going to be $15. That's an error on the sheet. They already talked about, I'm sure, talking the sign-ups. Okay. The week before Thanksgiving, I know you guys are busy all that week, but... keep an eye out for us. We'll be in the lobby all week. Moot court, mock trial, will be at the same table right as you walk in. You won't be able to miss us because we'll harass you all week. That's when the sign-ups are going to be for this competition. That's going to be your only opportunity to sign up. So please make sure you sign up that week if you're interested. You can pay us up front then. Give us your email, your student information. We'll put you onto the TWEN list for this website. It's going to be a controlled access TWEN site. And all the information for the website, or all the information for the competition will be on TWEN. The case file will be released on TWEN. Any questions that are asked will be answered to everyone on TWEN. There will be some discussions, some other examples available. We'll also have podcasts available on the TWEN site of other closing arguments. We're going to have Will or Elaney show you a closing argument in a little while. They're both preparing to go to competitions, so they both have closing arguments ready to go, and it's good practice for them. And it'll be a good opportunity for you guys to see what a student's closing argument looks like for a competition, since this is one of the things that you'll do if you end up on the mock trial team. Now, what is a closing argument? How many of you guys have ever seen Law & Order? All right. For the people who didn't raise their hands about never seeing Law & Order, anybody ever worked for a court? Have you ever seen a closing argument? Okay. A closing argument is pretty much the sexiest part of trial work. Opening argument, you don't get to do anything. You can't say anything I said opening argument. It's actually an opening statement. You can't argue anything during your opening. You'll actually get called on it by the court or by your opposing counsel. Direct examination, that's just getting the witness to tell you all of their story. Cross-examination, that's a little sexier because that's the part where you get to be, you killed him, didn't you, Mr. Smith? Closing is the best part because that's where you walk around and you look at the jury and you'd be like, shithead over here is the one that killed him, okay? Send him to jail. So this is the best part, and that's why we'd like to let you guys try that out, because if you have fun with closing, you'll have fun with the rest, but you got to learn how to do it first. I'm sorry, that was a shame comment. If you've ever, my current coach right now uses that phrase all the time. He yells at me for not doing my closing right, and he says, you got to say it like that. Anyway, so that's what we're going to ask you guys to do. It can be pretty short. It'll be a pretty simple case file. It's going to be one of the ones that we've used a few years ago, so all the kinks have been worked out of it. And we're going to make it a civil problem rather than a criminal problem because you guys are more familiar with all the civil rules right now. When that problem is released, you'll have an opportunity several weeks to ask us questions, to come watch sample arguments. We'll have a couple of sessions to give you guys pointers on what exactly goes into a good closing argument. And then on the day of the competition, you'll come in the morning of January 31st. And, we'll have two sessions, morning and afternoon. You'll give two closing arguments that day. You'll give them for a panel of judges, which will effectively be your jury. One of those people will probably be an outside practitioner. And then a couple of the other ones will be current members of the mock trial team. Now, one of the things that always freaks people out about this is that I've never given a closing argument. I don't like doing public speaking, things like this. I can assure you, I was scared as hell the first time I did it. I was so nervous I had a sheet of paper. The sheet of paper was shaking in my hand, so there's your first piece of advice. Bring a legal pad if you want to use notes, not a sheet of paper. Just bad. Don't worry. The person standing next to you is just as nervous. Better to get the nerves out now, because you're going to have to do things like this for your legal rhetoric classes coming up in the spring. So, guys, this is Great experience. Understand what it's like to get up on your feet. Understand what your weaknesses are. Understand what your strengths are. Find out what you like doing. This is why we've tried to keep the fees as low as you can, so you guys can try both of these competitions, decide what you want to do, because they really are different skill sets, and people tend to like one more than the other. Our spring qualifying tournament is also listed on this. This meeting isn't really for information about that, but the spring qualifier is how you end up on the mock trial team. That comes up at the end of February, beginning of March. The important thing to know about the 1L tournament is that you'll give those two arguments during your session, and then based on the scores that you get, we will invite four people back the next day. And this isn't really a measurement of whether these people will get on the team or not. This is simply so we have a tournament, and we can give a little bit extra play in the competitive nature of what goes into closing arguments. If you have any questions about it, my email and Scott's email are on the bottom. My email is drearm@gmail.com. Scott's is yy3065a@american.edu. For people who, I guess, don't have this information, my last name is drehgerm@gmail.com. Email us with questions. You can also email mocktrialhonorsociety@gmail.com with any questions that you have generally about mock trial. Elaine's looking like she has something she wants to say.
If you win, you'll get your name on a plaque.
Yeah, this is one of our big new achievements where we're making sure that well, Eleni, where is your name engraved in that plaque?
We don't have it yet.
Okay, so it's going to be a brand spanking new plaque. Eleni was actually the first person to win the 1L competition a couple of years ago. She beat me.
There won't be a plaque, well, I'm telling you.
Yes. Yeah. Eleni has now made sure that that's one of the key elements of her presidency. So there will be a plaque that's going to go up next to the brand spanking new trophy that we just got for winning our San Diego competition. Does anybody have any questions?
It's kind of like a little weird thing, but if you like sign up for this, do you look at the draw which day you get? Because Sunday is Super Bowl Sunday.
Hey, how about that? Well, okay. Sunday is actually. You sons of. They did that on purpose.
6 o'clock.
Yeah.
Here's Sunday by.
The two things that are important to know. Sunday is not one of the main competition days. Sunday is only the semifinals and finals that will happen in the morning. So you will be done with the semifinals and finals by lunchtime, easily by lunchtime, because we actually have lunch with the judges. So if you're planning on starting to drink for the Super Bowl by then...
Okay.
All right, see, well, my bills are not going to be in the Super Bowl, so I'm just not that glued to it. What's up?
If you're fortunate to advance, do you have to come up with another argument?
The question was, if you advance to the semifinals and finals, do you have to come up with another argument? The answer to that question is no, but it does bring up a question that I should answer really quickly. Getting back to the other part of that answer from your question before, you do not get to pick morning or afternoon, unfortunately, for that Saturday session. We just have to plug people in so that we get a pretty even number on both sides dealing with the number of judges that we get. For the competition. Now, your question about the argument. You will prepare an opening, or rather a closing argument, for both defense and plaintiff in this case file. So you're going to have to pick two, and you're pretty much just going to decide by a coin flip, or by the luck of when you walk in the morning. We're going to have a spreadsheet, and we're just going to assign people by when they walk in. So if the person who walked in before you was plaintiff, you're going to be defense, and vice versa. And then you'll switch up. We'll keep track of that. For your second session, you'll do the other argument. So you will have to prepare both. I had a question over here somewhere. Yes?
I'm trying. This is going to be like a real 1L question, but what is the difference between moot and...
The difference is pretty much what you just saw. Their area of expertise and their area of skills is appellate work. So what you just saw up here was an appellate argument. Those are the sort of arguments that, well, pretty much all the case files, all the cases that you guys are reading in all your classes where they say, oh, well, the court below screwed up because this, and the law is this. That's appellate work. That's where the court is deciding a question of law rather than a question of fact. Trial work is a question of fact. It's the first thing that you go into. It's pretty much all... Anytime somebody decides to sue anyone in a private action, any criminal action, the first level is always a trial because the facts have to be presented to either a judge or a jury. And so trial work focuses on bringing in witnesses. bringing in evidence, bringing in experts, whatever it is that the case requires, trial work is that element of advocacy. Whereas appellate work is this idea of standing in front of a panel of judges, much like, has anybody been down to the Supreme Court yet? You got to do that while you're here. If you live in Washington, you got to go see the Supreme Court. That's what it is. What? All right, that's the next question. Anybody?
Yes. Okay, so what if it's like based on like getting facts, like the supplementary material that we see beforehand, like the facts, but then are you doing the research for the law that you apply to the facts, or are you given the law and you're saying, you know, connect the two?
Good question. No, you are not doing any research for this.
Okay.
In general, with a few exceptions, mock trial competitions are what we call a closed universe. So you're not allowed to go out and look up outside case law. You're not expected to look up outside case law. The things that always apply to mock trial are its federal rules of evidence in general. So I know none of you guys have taken evidence. That's one of the things that keeps you on the same plane, is that you will say things in your closing argument that are just not admissible, but that's okay. We won't hold that against you. You might get a couple of, you know, chuckles from the judges, but that's okay. You'll learn about it next year. We don't expect you to do any research. And for most mock trial competitions, that will always be the case.
Okay. Well, I guess my question is, like, you said that it's going to be, like, it's definitely going to be a civil question. And mm-hmm. So when you're actually, like, making your argument, like, what is the law that you draw upon? Or is it just, like, really obvious?
The law will be clear from the case file, because what you, one of the pieces that you'll get is the actual, yeah, is going to be the actual
statute.
Complaint and part of the statute. So, you know, you will know the elements are, this is a negligence action. You guys are all in torts. So, did that answer your question?
I don't like what legal rhetoric does. It's oral.
Actually, quite similar to what legal rhetoric does. And in fact, you'll have to do motions arguments in the spring in legal rhetoric classes. So you'll get something similar then. Yes?
If you are only doing closing arguments and not the rest of the trial, will what happened in the rest of the trial be presented in our information packet? Or can we just assume that we got great confessions out of the witnesses or whatever?
The rule in mock trial... That would be nice, you know, you made your witness cry on the stand and confess to the crime or something. No. The rule in mock trial is if you don't have any other information than what is in the case file, you can make a logical inference from that, but you can't run far beyond the facts that you have. So if somebody says that, you know, they drove their car, you know, to work that morning, then you can assume that the car worked and that it wasn't, you know, out of gas and things like that, but you can't assume that they drove from their grandmother's house 3 hours away. Logical inferences. So, I think that answers the question. Other questions?
I'm just wondering, is it just for this competition, is it only closing arguments, or for all mock trial, is it always a closing argument?
No, normally mock trials are full trials. You'll deliver a few pretrial arguments, an opening, a few directs, a couple of cross-examinations, and a closing argument. In this case, we're just asking you to present the closing because it requires the least amount of outside knowledge, and really, like I said before, it's the sexiest part. So, yes. We usually ask for no longer than 10 minutes because really these case files are so limited that you won't be able to talk for more than 10 minutes without looking for bad stuff to talk about. So, other questions? Okay. Seeing no more questions, if you have other questions that you remember later or something, feel free to email us. Feel free to ask at the end. We'll be around. And I'm going to turn the floor over to Aline.
Hi, I'm going to do a closing argument really quickly for a competition I'm going to this weekend. We'll see how well it works out. Just a little bit of background on the case. The defendant is being charged with wire fraud, transmission of wagering information, bribery in a sporting contest. He is a referee for the Professional Basketball Association who fixed games. So this really happened. I'm sorry?
On what side of it?
I'm prosecution.
Okay.
This case is about greed, cheating, and breaking the law. When the defendant fixed those basketball games, he was greedy, he was cheating, and he was a criminal. At the beginning of this case, my co-counsel, Assistant United States Attorney Keith Wynn, told you that we were going to prove three crimes in this case. Ladies and gentlemen, it's the end of the trial, and we have proved all three charges. You see, the defendant was a referee in the Professional Basketball Association. He was an average referee doing his job, going through a divorce. We all know how messy divorces are. That's when the defendant got greedy. That's when he decided that in order to get that money, he would fix basketball games. When he fixed those games, he broke the law. The defendant set up a gambling scheme with his barber, Sal Lucas. He would call his barber and give her a fake time to set up a hair appointment. As you heard from Sal Lucas, these fake times corresponded to which team she should bet on. 0-0 time, like 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock. That meant that the defendant, or that Sal Lucas, should choose the home team. A time that ended in a 30, like 1:30, 2:30, 3:30, that meant that Sal Lucas should bet on the visiting team. Now, you saw the evidence in this case. You saw those phone records. And Sal Lucas testified that from those phone records, the defendant called her 6 times in 3 weeks, every single time talking about their scheme, telling Sal Lucas which team to bet on. On the 14th, 2 days before the playoff game, the defendant called Sal Lucas and told her that he was going to fix it. So Sal Lucas sent out text messages to prospective bettors, letting them know that her inside man was going to make it happen. Those bettors texted Sal Lucas back, letting her know that, yeah, they were interested. In fact, put $1,000 on the home team. Sal Lucas did that. And 2 days later, the day of the game, the defendant texted her, told her which team to pick, why, and what he was going to do. He said, be there 4:30 on Saturday. It's been 34 days since my last trim, and it's starting to nag. Now, you heard from Sal Lucas that meant pick the visiting team because number 34 was injured. Later that night, Kansas City played Dallas, and Dallas won. Dallas, the visiting team, won. The scheme was a success. Because of that, the defendant, or Sal Lucas, paid the defendant $5,000. $5,000 in $5 bills and a shoebox that you saw was found in his car. Now, ladies and gentlemen, this didn't just happen once. It didn't just happen twice. This scheme occurred 12 different times. I don't know if you're good at math or not, but 12 times 5,000, that's $60,000 that the defendant received and didn't earn. There are three charges, or the defendant is being charged with three crimes in this case. We have the burden to prove those crimes beyond a reasonable doubt. Ladies and gentlemen, we have. Let's talk about the crimes that the defendant is being charged with. First, wire fraud. When the defendant sent Sal Lucas text messages and made phone calls related to the scheme, he committed wire fraud. The next crime, transmission of wagering information. When those phone calls and those text messages were related to fixing games, giving Sal Lucas information about which team to pick, which team to bet on, he committed transmission of wagering information. And finally, bribery in a sporting contest. When the defendant fixed those gains, he got $5,000 to do so. He committed bribery in a sporting contest. You see, ladies and gentlemen, we have proven every element of every crime beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, before you go back into the jury room, I want you to think about four things in this case. One, the phone records. Why was the defendant calling his barber six times in 3 weeks when he only got his hair cut once a month? I'll tell you why. Because they had a scheme and they were fixing games. Second thing I want you to think about is the text message. Be there 4:30 on Saturday. Sal Lucas told you he never came in for a haircut on Saturday. That was a code. The third thing, that big box of money. That box of money full of $5 bills found in the defendant's car. Finally, think about the witnesses you heard on the defense. You heard from the defendant's best friend and colleague who told you that the defendant made some shady calls on the 16th. And then you heard from an expert who was paid $25,000, but he didn't take the time to differentiate who called which foul. We go back into that jury room. You will not be able to reach any other conclusion than to find the defendant guilty. Find him guilty of wire fraud, find him guilty of transmission of wagering information, and find him guilty of bribery in a sporting contest. Thank you.
That's it. Do you guys have any like joint questions about the process for moot court, mock trial? No?
If you're ready,